of 19, and because it's a gut and stuff, and the subject or the matter in the bill will be covered in testimony, I'm not going to ask Diane to do an explanation of it, but I'm going to call up Mark Gibson and Representative Cruz.
Chair Cruz, Vice Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I would like you to know that fiscal just sent the committee -3 fiscal. The fiscal is an undetermined fiscal at this time, but I did give you a copy of what fiscal has provided us and Mr. Gibson at your plate, so you should look.
Yes, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Gibson. I'm the governor's policy advisor for health care and human services. Just as a personal note, I'd like to say I'm pleased to be sharing the witness stand this afternoon with Representative Cruz. I think this is what's sometimes referred to in the trade as a Kodak moment.
Will you wait while I go get my camera?
I'm testifying on behalf of the governor in favor of the -3 amendments to House Bill 2519. The Oregon Health Plan has been providing health care to low-income Oregonians since February of 1994. At the time it was enacted, its objective was to provide health coverage to all Oregonians. To do this, it had three distinct elements. First, it expanded our Medicaid system. At the time, Medicaid only covered persons up to approximately 50% of the federal poverty level, and the OHP made the bold move of expanding Medicaid access to 100% of the federal poverty level. In doing so, it provided access to a unique package of health care benefits based on a priority-setting process conducted by the Health Services Commission, combined with an appropriation decision made by the Legislative Assembly. This Medicaid expansion was unique among the 50 states because it articulated a policy which held that some health care services were more effective at improving health and maintaining health than others, and that benefit packages should be structured to provide the most beneficial services first. In addition, the policy said that when resources fall short of the ideal, services should be cut from coverage rather than people. The plan also created a method of providing coverage to persons unable to obtain health insurance due to pre-existing medical conditions. At the time, the insurance markets simply refused to cover persons who were at extremely high risk of having large medical claims, or in other cases, the premiums charged were prohibitive. The OHP created a high-risk pool that made insurance available and more affordable to persons unfortunate enough to find themselves losing or without insurance coverage at a time when they had already contracted a serious illness. Finally, the plan enacted an employer mandate which required employers to provide health insurance coverage to all employees working more than 17 and a half hours per week. Now, in the intervening time, two major events have taken place. Due to policy changes in Oregon, the employer mandate was repealed. This created an enormous shortfall in reaching our policy objective of making health care coverage accessible to all Oregonians. However, since that time, we've been working together to incrementally reduce the number of uninsured Oregonians, and we've made progress. In the early days of the OHP, approximately 18% of Oregonians were uninsured. Today, that number is about 10%. Perhaps more importantly, we've managed to lower the rate of uninsured children in our state from 21% to approximately 7%. While not exclusively responsible for these impressive gains, the OHP has played a major role in this progress. In addition to repealing the mandate, after initially approving our waiver request and allowing some minor adjustments to the level of coverage under the package, under the Oregon Health Plan, the federal government stopped granting adjustments to the benefit package. This returned us to a policy approach that said you can balance your budget by dropping coverage entirely for certain populations, but you cannot reduce the benefit level of anyone who remains covered. In other words, if we want federal matching funds for our medical assistance programs, there can be no reduction in the benefits provided unless a person is disqualified from coverage altogether. All told, these events have left us with about 350,000 Oregonians still uninsured. Too often, this lack of health insurance causes them to delay seeking care. It results in preventable suffering and unnecessary cost, and it reduces their productivity. In addition, these changes left us without the ability to modify our benefit package in order to expand or maintain coverage. The Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2519 are the next step in moving us toward the goal of universal access to health care, and they also change benefit levels in doing so. Section 1 is a preamble that discusses the progress we've made, the challenge that lies ahead, and the fact that the costs of delayed care are borne by all of us who are fortunate enough to have health insurance coverage. Section 2 sets out a policy framework for the changes we hope to make in the Oregon Health Plan. It reaffirms our goal of universal access to health care services. It recognizes that there must be a standard basic level of care to which Oregonians have access. It recognizes that the state, the federal government, employers, and individuals all have a role to play in a public-private partnership that provides access to health care for Oregonians. It recognizes that the role of each of these partners should be clearly defined and that public subsidies should be based on the ability to pay. Section 2 also recognizes that except for Oregonians with special medical vulnerabilities, public subsidies should be limited to providing the standard basic level of care that the healthcare delivery system and that the healthcare delivery system should encourage the use of healthcare services that truly improve health. Section 3 sets as our goal providing access to the standard basic level of care for all Oregonians up to 200% of the federal poverty level. That's an income of approximately $35,000 per year for a family of four. This is a significant number because when Oregon families' income reaches this level, virtually all of them have access to insurance and have the personal resources to fulfill any cost-sharing requirements. Section 4 sets out the process for determining what will be included in the standard benefit package. It uses the experience and knowledge of the Health Services Commission, which has created and modified the priority list used in the OHP up to now. It uses the commission in creating the new benefit package, but it does not require the commission to use the existing priority list, but rather gives the commission additional flexibility to create priorities that are more relevant to a less comprehensive benefit package. Section 4 also creates the OHP Plus benefit package for Oregonians who are medically vulnerable. The intent of the bill is to provide persons who are medically vulnerable, that is, children, pregnant women, the aged, blind, and persons with disabilities, with the same benefit package they are receiving at present. Section 5 sets guidelines for the public subsidies that will be offered under the new OHP approach. It requires subsidies to be based on ability to pay. It requires the OHP to provide subsidies to both public and private coverage. It requires the state to seek federal matching funds for all subsidies, whether the coverage is provided through a public program or through private insurance. Section 5 also provides that certain cost sharing may be required based on the ability to pay, and it states that the objective of creating a seamless, it is our objective to create a seamless continuum of health care coverage from full public subsidy to coverage financed entirely by private resources. Section 6 directs the state to seek waivers from the federal government to reach the objectives spelled out in the bill. Governor Kitzhaber urges you to join him in supporting these changes to the OHP. We believe these changes will help us extend access to health care coverage to between 50 and 70,000 additional Oregonians. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Or Mark Gibson. Okay. I'll wait. Okay. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that respectful enough?
That's fine.
Okay.
That's acceptable.
For the record, I'm Jeff Cruz, State Representative from District 45. Mark did a very good job of summarizing what's in the bill. I guess what I want to do is lay out some of the background that got us here. It may appear strange for Mr. Gibson and I to be sitting here at this table together to some people, but we have spent many hours in either my office or his, so we're used to being with each other now, relatively speaking. When we started looking at our healthcare system in the last couple of years and trying to figure out a way to keep it affordable and to keep trying to move towards the original objectives, what we found was that the biggest barrier we had was indeed the federal government because of the lack of flexibility we had in the way we could implement it. And one of the things we also found was that we had working poor Oregonians who were eligible for the Oregon Health Plan being trapped inside that health plan because when they reached the upper limit of it, they couldn't really afford to move beyond it because they couldn't have health care coverage at that point. And so we were trying to figure out some way to develop a seamless system that wouldn't have such sharp drop-offs in it. And we think that we have come up with a concept that will do that. Another thing that we looked at was how we could truly get a merger of the public and private sector, because that had been something that hadn't been able to happen. And we think that in this model, we have a way that we can truly do that. So what we're trying to create is a seamless system that does not penalize somebody for being economically mobile, so that if you get a better job, get a pay increase, that you're not going to be severely penalized for that activity. And this system will allow that to happen, because in this process, your contribution to your health care will increase incrementally rather than have sharp drop-offs in it. I do want to thank the governor. He has been incredibly straightforward on this. He called me this morning from D.C. He had a conversation yesterday with Tommy Thompson, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And we have a very strong feeling that the Secretary is going to endorse our proposal, and we are going to get an incredible level of flexibility in the way we can use federal matching funds that I don't think anybody has ever had before. Oregon really is front again in our approach to healthcare delivery. And I think there'll be a lot of states that are going to be looking at us and see how we perform with this thing. I think what this really speaks to is the fact that when we are looking at public policy from a long-term perspective, it stops being a partisan issue altogether. I think the long-term savings we are going to get here are something that we can't calculate at this point in time, because this does move us to preventive medicine. This does move us towards people having responsibility for their own health care, and it moves us away from people just having access to the system for catastrophic reasons. And we don't know at this point in time if we get to universal access, but that's going to be a funding decision, and we know that. But this moves us significantly closer than we are now. If one was looking for significant savings in the health plan right now, this isn't going to get us there. But it's going to get us to a distribution of our resources to a way that does a better job of serving the needs of Oregonians. I am incredibly excited about this concept. I think it's a great one. We happen to be very lucky at this point in time to have been thinking along these lines, and then have a secretary of an agency who has been through the battle with the federal government. As everybody knows, Tommy Thompson was the governor of Wisconsin, and he fought the same battles we did with HCFA and the inflexibility of that agency. And it just so happened that all the stars lined up, and we have a guy who understands the need for a state to be in charge of their own system, and understands that a state can probably do a better job of managing the resources than some regimented federal program. Mm-hmm. And so we are incredibly excited. if all promises happen the way they should and things fall in line, we may actually have a response to this waiver request from the federal government within 2 or 3 weeks, which is also unheard of. But it's a new day, and I'm just glad that we were in a position in Oregon to take advantage of this new environment. And I urge passage of this bill. This is, I think, a significant step towards where we want to go in healthcare delivery in the state of Oregon.
Questions? Representative Montes Anderson.
Okay. My greatest concern, of course, will be for safety net clinics and how these impact safety net clinics and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taking a look at Section 5 subsidies.
Right.
Under basically line 15 through 24, number 4 and 5, where we're talking that the state shall pay a portion of the cost of the Oregon Health Plan standard on a sliding scale based on income, with the greatest subsidy at the lowest income level. So if we have a patient that comes in and they are below the 200% level, we give them services, but their income is such that they wouldn't get all free services. What's going to happen then is the state will only pay for a certain amount, and so then it would be up to the safety net clinics to get the rest of that money from the patient. Is that what this says?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Montes Anderson, this is more from the perspective of the subsidy that the individual would receive to become insured. And so the safety net clinic, if it had a relationship with the Oregon Health Plan insurer in that area or other insurers in that area, would then receive payment based on the relationship the safety net clinic had with the insurer. What this talks about here is the personal responsibility to participate in the cost of being covered. And then it also talks about the fact that there could be co-payments required on an individual basis. It actually covers both, and your point's well taken. There will be the possibility of having additional individual co-payments around certain services.
So it's paying for the cost of the insurance?
Both the cost of the insurance, and at times there will be a co-payment that accompanies certain services.
So that means the rules of this then would be developed by Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Munns Anderson, that's correct. The rules would be developed. A lot of the detail that it takes to really specify every piece of how we would implement this would be left to the rulemaking process and the creation of our Medicaid plan.
And follow up. I'm sorry. So who's involved in actual the rulemaking? I mean, are we? I guess I'm mainly familiar with CARE Oregon and that impact. So, of course, I'm concerned about how that's going to affect CARE Oregon. I'm sure that there are other plans throughout the state that are like that. Will they be involved in this rulemaking process or – yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montes Anderson, my expectation is absolutely they'll be involved. The usual administrative rulemaking process and the process of putting together our Medicaid plan is one that provides for folks that are involved and interested in that process to take part in it. And so certainly they would have a voice in that process and be able to make their concerns and thoughts about the best way to do these to finish out these details known to the agency.
Okay. And one other follow-up. Thank you. We had a copay in Clackamas County, only $5. They only had to pay $5 if they were Oregon Health Plan payment. We had a real struggle with getting them to even pay the $5. That's just for the record. I feel that people who are getting services, if they can pay $5 buy gum instead of buying cigarettes, they should be paying $5 to receive services. But just for the record, that's very difficult to get money out of the low-income people for health care services.
Mr. Chair.
I'm the chair.
I know. I was looking at you when I said that. Keep in mind, committee, that this is a general document. What we are selling to HCFA at this point in time is a concept and getting an endorsement of the concept. Certainly, there's going to be a lot of detail work that's going to go on after this fact. And in fact, I think the governor was talking about having Hirsch and some folks, maybe even as early as later in sometime next week, going back to start working on the details of this. And also there, we will have some legislative pieces that follow this also. And I think we've had a work group that's been working on this. It's been rather small because of necessity, but fairly broad in the scope of those who have been participating. And we have envisioned that it's going to take probably a number of work groups after the fact to deal with the details of this and what the actual structure actually looks like. So we've been mindful of all of that, and that will proceed. But the first and most important thing we had to do was get the federal government to buy in to the concept of how we want to change the healthcare system in Oregon and why it's going to be beneficial, and that is the purpose of this document.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Representative Barnhart.
I assume, Representative, that the reason for the generality of this thing is that when it comes right down to it, you want a document which is general enough so that you can fit whatever negotiations and agreements you're able to reach with Secretary Thompson on the matter, so that they'll fit within inside of this thing.
Yes.
And so if we try to write the thing in a very specific way, we could end up sideways of what the federal government's willing to agree to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, you're exactly right. You know, if we were in a traditional position of having to present this to HCFA and go through all of those hoops, we'd have probably had a different document. But we made the decision early on we're going to go to the top of the food chain. And what Governor Kitzhaber said to me this morning was that Secretary Thompson is excited about this. He said one of his people said, "Mr. Secretary, we're not sure we can do this," and Secretary Thompson's response was, "Why not? I like it." So there is some benefit to having a connection at that level, and so that will help us expedite getting through the hoops. Certainly, we're still going to have to get through the hoops. Certainly, we're still going to have to approve match for the federal funds and all the things that are required, but this connection directly to the Secretary was what we envisioned from the beginning and why we are taking this approach to it.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were not fortunate enough to have this resolved before the session is over, could we do a piece of legislation that would entitle us to go forward with the program once the waiver does come forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, we've thought about that, and one of the things we have yet to do, once we kind of get the parameters here, is to put in place legislation that we would hope would allow us to go ahead and build the detail of this, and at the point in time when this waiver would take effect, to where it could just be an e-board decision to implement, and so we're looking at that.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions, and please, either one of you, feel free to answer them. On page 2, lines 1 and 2, it talks about it's the policy of the state to move toward providing a system of universal access to health care services. Can you explain to me the difference between universal access and what we have been referring to as universal coverage or universal health care?
Your turn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, there has always been a recognition, I think, on the part of those on folks that are involved in trying to fine-tune our health care system, or actually trying to make major changes in our health care system, that coverage does not always equal access. That is, a person can have health insurance coverage but may not have a provider that is suitable, may not be able to have transportation to get the service they need or what have you, and they may have coverage but not be able to get the access to the services that they actually need. As a goal statement, the goal here is to get Oregonians access to the services they need. What the bill actually talks about is removing one of the greatest barriers to access, and that is the inability to pay. So one of the biggest steps we believe we can make toward providing that access if needed is to provide folks with coverage so that they have a payer associated with them, and they can then have a contract with a provider that will see them when the time is right and when they need to provide them with the preventive services they need, provide them with the intervention when they're ill. So I think the reason access is mentioned in specific here is because it is the access to services that is the ultimate objective in maintaining and improving the health of that patient. But we recognize, too, that the rest of this bill deals with getting the coverage that enables the access.
So a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So since the greatest barrier is the inability to pay, really what you're terming as universal access becomes universal coverage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, universal coverage would be one of the biggest steps we could take toward universal access. After that, if everyone were covered, then it would be fine-tuning the system in terms of removing any of the other small barriers that exist. But I think I would agree with the inference that the greatest barrier at this point is a lack of coverage.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Further down in that same section in sub 5, it talks about all subsidies being explicit and based on an individual's ability to pay. You testified that starting at the 200% level of poverty, which would be about $35,000 annual, and then moving down from there, that the subsidy would be greater the lower the income is concerned. So, what will happen with this kind of language in here is that people that basically have no income, and if they're not already being covered through Social Security disability or Medicare or some other form, they would have a full subsidy, so that there would be no personal cost to them. Do you know what that does as far as not necessarily access, but what that does as far as utilization is concerned? Because one of the things that this program is initially built on is lower utilization.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, the program as it exists right now has very little cost sharing for persons who are categorically eligible. That is, people who are routinely covered under federal Medicaid law. We have a modest premium payment that's required of persons who are not categorically eligible under federal law but qualify for the health plan under 100% of the federal poverty level. We don't, and the utilization at in those programs has been reasonable. Obviously, occasionally there's an outlier. Somebody overutilizes, but that's the nature of a system, and that's the nature of dealing with humanity. On the other hand, we think that the utilization for those folks that are currently in the system is at reasonable levels, and we believe that having stated in policy that we want to base the personal participation on the ability to pay and making that graduated gives us the leverage we need to argue that case strongly with the federal government. I think a good example of what we would envision doing is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program that exists today, whereby a person who has an income level of about 100%, just above 100% of the federal poverty level, may no longer qualify for Medicaid, but the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program subsidizes 95% of the cost of the individual to get the coverage. As that person's income goes up, by the time that person reaches 170% of the poverty level, that subsidy drops substantially down to the 50% range. So I think that's the balance we're trying to strike. And we, I think our utilization experience at this point in time would lead us to believe there may be some select places where we could use co-payments to help decrease inappropriate utilization, but by and large, there wouldn't be large changes for folks in the very poor categories, in the very low income categories.
Jim, follow up, Mr. Chair. The next section, sub 6, starting on line 15, it talks about the healthcare delivery system encourages the use of healthcare services, including appropriate education, early intervention, and prevention. I don't disagree with those. Although prevention is always a matter of lifestyle and a matter of choice, appropriate education may be what a person wants to listen to. How will having that as a policy reduce the utilization that we talked about in sub 5, and how can that then as far as saving the money for higher level types of costs, low incidence, high cost types of illnesses, which we see more and more of?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, this is more of a goal. I don't think we necessarily look at that as a goal that we can put immediate numbers to. But what we're after here really is kind of a culture change in the way people view healthcare at current time, whether you're in the private market or private sector, or public sector. You know, your health care is there and somebody's picking up the tab for it, and with some exceptions you have co-pays and things like that. But what we are after is a culture change to make people give them responsibility for their own health and to try to instill in the public the fact that lifestyle changes, as you talked about, have long-term benefits, and that regular checkups rather than waiting until something bad happens might avoid the bad things happening. And so you know, that's why education is in there, because a lot of this is going to be an effort to educate the people in a better way to manage themselves and their own health care. So, you know, I would say that if there are savings in there, we're talking more in the long term than immediate. But it is, you know, it's kind of the philosophy we undertook in doing this is making people responsible for their own actions and activities and trying to put in place a system that will allow them to do that and to do the preventative things that will help them avoid more catastrophic consequences.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. With regards to nursing home care, how will that either, I would like to say, improve under nursing home assisted care and that sort of thing? How will that improve under this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I think this, you're right, this is a logical follow-on to the discussion about prevention. I think I maybe could bring a couple of examples to the fore. One good example, I think, of an early intervention that really works to delay costs downstream, including long-term care costs, is the appropriate management of hypertension. Prevents strokes, prevents acute cardiac disease, which can lead to disabling conditions. And in addition to that, another good example where education plays that role is in the treatment of diabetes. Education about how to manage the disease, about how to manage your lifestyle can measurably improve results. And every one of those, in each of those situations, to the extent that these early interventions, these educational activities, and the preventive care is able to forestall a deterioration of the patient's condition and the and forestall the onset of disabling symptoms, then that helps mitigate costs in the long run.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That didn't necessarily answer my question, by the way, as far as immediate, you know, what are we going to do? A little earlier this session, more as a comment, Mr. Chair, I heard the governor talking about, was it Max and Florine or somebody that was the old woman in the hospital and the newborn? So I guess the next question that I have, getting off the nursing home care then, is because we have people now that need nursing home care, you know, 30 years from now, there's some of us others in the room that may need it unless we change our lifestyles. But with regards to newborn care, how is this going to fit in with the governor's children's plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, to the extent that that healthcare interventions are a critical part of supporting a healthy family, this meshes very well, I think, with the children's plan. The more that we can bring appropriate health intervention to families and whole families, not just children but whole families, and much of the expansion that would be envisioned in this process would be to parents of children. To the extent that we can improve the health of families, not just children but also the parents, I think we improve their ability to grow as a healthy family unit and be both as productive as possible in terms of supporting themselves and also to be able to learn and function well in school as the children grow. So to the extent that we make sure that Oregonians with lower incomes have access to the health care services that they need, that augments the efforts that we would make dovetails well and augments the efforts we would make for the children's plan.
Let me also point out that the part of the design of this is we aren't creating separate categories of Oregonians here. This universal access means all Oregonians. This is designed to be a non-stigmatizing healthcare system. And we do have on record the fact that there are people who might qualify the Oregon Health Plan now who do not want to be on quote-unquote public assistance that refuse to take advantage of what they are eligible for. This, with the blended funding we're going to do, the stigma is gone from it because everybody is contributing to the benefits they are getting. And so this, you know, on the public dole or whatever you want to call it, stigma disappears with this system. And so there, you know, we're in that way also removing another barrier to people trying to access health care. So, if we get these waivers and we can actually do the amount of CHIP match that we're eligible for in this state, so that all kids do have coverage, you know, then I think I understand your concern, but I think that point's moot because the health care will be there.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
One last question.
Since insurance companies are pulling out now of the Oregon Health Plan statewide, basically, because we're starting to see it now in the metro area as well, how is this going to basically ebb that tide? How is this going to keep the insurance companies interested in continuing to participate?
Well, number one, let me say, and also we have some providers that are not real excited about their participation level either. And so one of the things we intend to address in this is what sort of reimbursement rates are necessary and equitable to keep all of the players in the game. And plus, what we are doing here is if we are allowing the private sector insurance companies to develop a package of benefits that as long as, and one of the things, you know, whether it's actuarially equivalent to base to mandated Medicaid, and there's a lot of details to work out in this, but the design of this is for them to offer something that is a benefit package that's real for the people that would be subscribing to it, but something that fits in their model of the way they do their book of business, rather than to try to get them to match the way they do business onto a more of a public system. So we're looking at a private sector model with public funds coming in to augment. So it's a different dynamic, and our feeling is that we will get private participation.
Sounds better and better.
Yeah.
Representative Bodis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on this, I really like this idea. I know there's going to be some services then that won't be covered by the Oregon Health Plan, but I think the intent is then to have a broader base of health care services that are reimbursed at a rate that would keep providers and insurance companies happy, is, you know, because then they're not losing money on this population. Is that what I'm hoping is going to come out of this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mons Anderson, that is the objective. I think there are a couple of things we need to recognize. There have been there has been an exodus of large insurers from the health plan. That's undeniable. I think there's an important group that we need to recognize that has stepped up into the gap that was left by that, and that is a group of providers around the state called community-based Oregon Health Plan providers, and they exist in many of our communities around the state. You've mentioned Care Oregon previously. That's one of such providers. But they exist in everywhere from Grants Pass to Klamath Falls on around the state, Eugene here in Marion County, and so on. And one of the things we're doing to maintain the solvency of those providers, there's no denying the fact that their margins are razor thin. But one of the things we're doing is our budget has some significant increases in OHP per capita capitation payments during this budget cycle so that those providers can remain solvent. I think the other place where, on the commercial side, where this has a real impact is if we're able to get the waivers we want, we will leverage in substantial additional federal funds. And we'll be able to utilize those federal funds to help subsidize group coverage for persons who currently have group coverage offered to them through their place of employment, but don't have the personal resource to pay the copayment or the coinsurance that goes along with it. So that's a place where our commercial insurance markets will see an increase in patients or an increase in enrollment that can come to them through that subsidized group insurance coverage.
And also keep in mind that anybody in the system has the ability to buy additional coverage if they choose without being penalized on the base coverage that they have in the system. Mm-hmm. So there's several types of flexibility that will be built into this.
I would think that the thousands of Oregonians who will benefit from the Oregon Health Plan probably owe a pretty good debt of gratitude to Representative Cruz, Mr. Gibson, and to Governor Kitzhaber for the efforts of making this thing possible today. So I think that should be on the record.
And also for the record, I do want to thank Mark for the many hours we have put in on this. Starting with the mental health work group, we've been an inordinate amount of time together over the last year or so, and I think we're heading in a direction that Oregonians can be proud of.
Any other questions, Representative Tillman?
I just want to add to what you were saying. I wonder, the whole state owes the two of you and other people who worked on this a debt of gratitude, and thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Barnard.
I just want to wish you luck. I hope you can pull it off. You know, it occurred to me that one of the reasons that the two of you sitting at the same table doesn't look so strange is because it's Little Oregon ganged up against the feds, and I hope you're able to pull it off. I wanted to say one more thing, and that is that when I was campaigning for the legislature, there were lots and lots of people from all income levels and all circumstances who talked about the problems of getting adequate health insurance and adequate health care. And the plan that you two have described and the flexibility of it and the inclusion of the commercial insurance companies and providers, of course, who have to make a living, sounds to me like it's going to go a long way for dealing with a lot of the concerns that a lot of my constituents raised. So I really appreciate it.
I'd also like to say that Mark and I are sitting up here taking credit for a lot of hard work by a lot of other folks. So we just happen to be the people with the paper. So thank you very much.
Anyone else that wish to testify? Seeing none, I'll wait till the chair gets back off here.
He said public hearing.
I thought we were in a public hearing.
He opened public hearing.
What I'd like to know, Mr. Chair, is will we get an opportunity to hear from Jeff Hetherington about this? Will we get an opportunity to hear from Jeff Hetherington about this? Isn't he the executive director of Care Oregon, one of the organizations that would be impacted by this? Is there anybody else that we're going to hear from, or is that it?
There's probably a whole lot of people like to testify. I want to remind the committee that we are trying to expedite process. We have to go to the floor, and we need to get this filed so we can have it on the floor Friday.
I have a note from Beth Beyer, who is in opposition to this. I don't know if she wants to testify, but I do have a note. And did you... If this is a public hearing, we should hear this.
We can't. We don't have a work.
Okay. I apologize for opening the public hearing when I couldn't do that. So we've been in work session.
Mr. Chair, I understand that we need to, that there's some timelines on this one. And maybe if you take just a minute to describe those, it may make it easier for us.
Okay. One of the things that we have some assurances on at this point in time is an amazingly quick turnaround at the federal level on a decision on this waiver. With the understanding that we have other legislation that we need to do on the backside once we know if this becomes a reality, it was our desire to move it through the process fairly quick so that the governor could sign it, and so because we need an actual bill. And that's one thing. And the other thing, the perception of being able to move a bill through the process quickly like that also sends a strong signal. So our intention was to actually have this bill on the floor of the House tomorrow, and so it could be over to the Senate the first part of the week. I talked to the governor about that this morning. He is fine with that. We would be probably scheduling it for a hearing in a Senate committee on Tuesday and then immediately to the floor of the Senate so the governor could put a signature on it so we could get it back to Tommy Thompson.
Are you ready for a motion?
Yeah.
I move the Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2519. Is there any discussion?
Yes. I am very excited about doing some health care reform in the state of Oregon. I want it on the record that we need to get organizations like Care Oregon, and I think it's Mary Lou Henrich, who is the executive director of that. Jeff Hetherington, I think, is in charge of some other group, and I forget the name. I apologize. But to me, it's extremely important to have their input on the ramifications of this to their particular programs. But that's down the line. Yeah.
Okay, and Representative, we have had conversations about that in the work group and about the need for those organizations to have a large enough base to be viable, I think that fits in with the plan we're developing. So Mr. Gibson and I had a conversation about that just a few days ago. So any other discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, dash three amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tomac.
I move House Bill 2519 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomac moves House Bill 2519 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Thank you.
Yeah, we don't want that original stuff.
Right.
As amended with a due pass recommendation, any discussion? Representative Tomac.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no vote on this, and the primary reason why, or reasons why, is that number one is that I think that it is sending us down the road of the beginning of a single-payer system, which I have a real objection to, and my primary objection to a single-payer system is that usually the government is who takes it over and becomes a single-payer. You see that in Canada, and now we know why the Canadian doctors are coming down here to practice and people from Canada come down here for health care is because of their lack of choices. I don't see how this is in reading the bill and in the answers that I got from Mr. Gibson and Representative Cruz. I don't really see how this is going to help the frail elderly. I also don't see how this is going to do anything as far as nursing home care is concerned or care for people that are in assisted living type centers and still need some kind of state assistance. I really, quite frankly, don't see us increasing any kind of funding in this particular area. While I don't disagree with appropriate education, early intervention, and prevention, I think those are all admirable things. And I think that it's those types of things do take a lifestyle change. I'm not so sure that we can just say it is so in a piece of legislation to make it happen, to actually make people want to go out and exercise, to make people want to quit smoking, to make people want to watch their diet and their blood pressure and all of the other things that goes along with that. I'm also concerned with regards to how this continuum, seamless continuum that is referenced in subsection 6 on page 3 is how that's going to actually be pulled up. So I think that it hasn't been demonstrated that that this is going to be the vehicle that can get us where it is that we want to go. Hopefully I'll be proven wrong. But the other thing is that with regards to health insurance, and how people get health insurance, whether it's through employment or through their own devices of being able to purchase affordable health care service or health care insurance, I'm not sure that this gets us there. And the other thing I'm concerned about with this is utilization. I'm not so sure that this is going to reduce the utilization that we have on the Oregon Health Plan, and that is a major concern when we look at, especially when people that are on the system that use it, use their visits to their doctor as one of their means of socialization, I think that there's a real problem there. So for those reasons, I'm in that vote.
Any other discussion? Representative Mona Sanderson.
I will be voting in favor of this just because I've worked too many years with families who do not have access to basic health care. And I know that I think that every Oregonian should have access to basic health care. And yes, there's going to be some give and take on some of the services that are provided. But it's critical, I think, to the health of Oregonians that we start looking at a different way. And if we can get more money from the feds, boy, that's the way we should go.
Any discussion? Committee, keep in mind, this is a bill, it's a vision, it is a vehicle to get a waiver. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
We've already had.
Representative
Hummel?
No.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Montanus?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2519, having
you. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, before you, I'm sorry, I lost track. Is there more than one no vote?
No.
Okay, thank you.
House Bill 2519, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and, oh, I think I'll carry it. Propose a work session on House Bill 2519.
And you got to go to work, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to.
You don't want, well, that's mine. Never mind.
No, this is to give the governor authority to go bargain.
Absolutely.
Oh, I know. They're going to run it soon. They're going to run it soon. Yeah. Second reading is today. Yeah. Second reading is today. So we can vote for that.
Go ahead and open on 2763.
Okay, we will open a work session on House Bill 2763. Diane disappeared too.
I assume that we closed the one on 2519.
I believe he did.
Okay.
But I will close 2519 just to make sure.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Understandably, I'm pretty new to this bill, but I'll read Diane's summary. The bill requires, House Bill 2763 requires health benefit plans that cover prescription drugs to issue uniform prescription drug identification cards. Details information to be listed on those cards requires the cards to be capable of processing or adjudicating a claim electronically. The bill requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to develop rules. It allows insurers to pay non-pharmacy information on the same card as pharmacy information, such information that would be used by a physician's office for billing, and the bill provides for exceptions. I also, in my hand, and I'll be passing these out, have copies of the Dash 4 amendments to the bill. Diane did not tell me before she departed who submitted these. So, hoping that...
Dash 4?
Yes, I have them right here. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
And so I'll go ahead and hand those out and let you all take a look at them for a few moments.
Okay, we'll pause the committee while.
Thank you.
The Dash 4s are passed out.
Is this a good... What are you doing,
Bill? Oh,
that's enough.
Okay.
7, 6, 6.
Yes, I believe looking briefly at these, having seen them for about 15 seconds now, I can tell you that it does appear as though the Dash 4 amendments replaced the bill.
Yeah.
And so let me read Diane's notes here as to the effects of the amendments. Actually, I'll go ahead and try and just summarize them. Perhaps we could...
I think we're in desperate need of that.
Certainly. Okay, Section 3 of the Dash 4 Amendments stipulates that a carrier which provides coverage for prescription drugs shall issue to the enrollee a prescription drug identification card that contains all information required for proper claims adjudication. Upon renewal of a health benefit plan, a carrier or administrator shall issue the prescription drug identification card or other technology. The carrier or administrator is not required to issue a prescription drug identification card or other technology separate from another identification card or technology issued to an enrollee under the health benefit plan if the identification card or technology contains all the information required for proper claims adjudication.
And I see
Mr. Wilson coming forward to perhaps...
Vice Chair Farrard, members of the committee, you
yes,
may want our help.
Bail us out.
Thank you.
If you'll recall, I introduced this bill. For the record, my name is J.L. Wilson, representing the State Pharmacists Association for House Bill 2763. And as you'll recall, I introduced this bill to allow for uniform pharmacy cards. The impetus behind the bill was, of course, to allow pharmacists be pharmacists. It was the fact that they are unable to process their claims right the first time, most of the time, was a problem for the industry. Chair Cruz asked us to get together with their insurers and see if we could come up with language agreeable to both of us. These are Mr. Bishop's amendments. I'm pleased to say that we are all in agreement with this language and would urge its adoption and ultimate passage.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, representing Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Northwest. We're presenting the Dash 4 amendments for the committee's consideration, and what we did here was take a Washington bill that is on the governor's desk and should be signed into law soon up there, and we are mirroring those provisions in this alternative. So the effect, if these amendments are approved, is that both Oregon and Washington will be on parallel tracks in coming up with a uniform prescription card. And our objective was not to have inconsistent state standards, at least between our two Northwest states. And it seemed that mirroring those Washington provisions was appropriate. We offered that as a suggestion to Mr. Wilson, and they found that acceptable. So that's why we're bringing these amendments forward to the committee at this point.
Are there any questions of Mr. Powell or Mr. Wilson or Mr. Bishop? Representative Modus Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the greatest concern was from the various insurance companies and public agencies in having to reformat and come up with a certain software or a card and have to revamp. So basically this bill, would it have been the buy-in of our insurance companies and our public agencies that were so opposed to the original bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, I can't speak for everyone by any means, but I can speak for Kaiser Permanente, and because this is going to be the law in Washington State, and in fact most carriers, most of the major carriers in Oregon also do business in Washington, we're going to have to comply anyway, and that's why having these provisions and having them the same seemed appropriate for us. You will note that there is rulemaking authority in the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish specific requirements and to look at national standards and requirements of federal law. And so our goal will be that those become appropriate standards that carriers can administer and that are helpful to pharmacists as well.
Mr. Barnard, Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks as though the pharmacy in this bill gets a requirement that all the information be contained on the card, all the information necessary. So you don't have to call in for it.
Chair Garrard, Representative Barnhart, looking at the language of Section 3, Sub 1 on the bill,
yeah.
That I feel that you're right.
Okay. And follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
It looks as though you might get the formatting if the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services decides on that issue.
Chair Garrard, Representative Barnhart, as it's been said before, I think we're going to kick that off to the certified smart people. I think we'll all have our chance to weigh in and come up to something we agree with.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could one of you direct or talk about Section 4, about the Department of Consumer Business Services and adopting the rules?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, our goal here is to establish broad legislative standards and then have the insurance commissioner and the Department of Consumer and Business Services come up with specific rules that not only look at national standards but take into account federal law changes that are going to be coming into force so that we've created appropriate standards that we can live with. And rather than trying to prescribe those in statute, we're providing the broad authorization by these amendments for the department to implement by rule.
So the idea is that eventually there would be a standard format that all insurance companies would follow. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fulman, yes.
Great. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Dave Fiscom, I just wanted to, representing Providence and Pacific here, in response to Representative Monis Anderson, I just wanted to amplify briefly, and I will do so at your discretion. After the hearing on this bill, the chair wanted the insurers and Mr. Wilson's group to go away and find an agreement, not just to discuss one, but to find one, and we did. We had one work group meeting with our pharmacists from three health plans in the room, along with the lobbyist representatives of those health plans. Mr. Powell from Regents was there along with his pharmacist. Mr. Wilson and his colleagues were there. We proceeded to have further phone calls, not another meeting. The upshot of all of those discussions was this agreement today. So without trying to say there is unanimity in favor of every word in the document, there is a clear consensus in favor of that. And we took those actions at the direct instigation of the chair at the first hearing when we took his instructions in a straightforward manner and went to work and had what we told you last time was very important, which is pharmacist-to-pharmacist conversations, and that occurred, as I say, face-to-face once and by phone further since your last hearing. That's why you have the -4 amendments before you today.
We've been joined by John Powell, and John, as I recall, you were opposed to this. Where are you as far as the -4s are concerned?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I think as the preceding witnesses have testified, what we were really asking for was a forum to allow the people who work in this area of pharmacy, both for health plans and retail pharmacists, to get together to come up with something that's workable. I think the amendments only saw them for the first time today, so, and the person I report to at Regents is at a conference, so I'm winging it here. This is more in line with what we think will provide what the pharmacists want, and at the same time be conscious of any costs that might be attributable to this process by, again, getting those people together in a process of making rules and letting them talk about what they need at the retail level and what works. So this is much preferable to adopting a standard that's being set somewhere, although that standard is referenced here and will be considered indeed. It doesn't delegate that authority. It keeps it in Oregon, and the people working in Oregon will sit down and work this out.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. Bruce Bishop referred to the fact that the state of Washington has something very similar to this. Is that a result of your meeting? Did you get to them up there and have them adopt your language?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Seriously, did you discuss that? Did that have a bearing on your decision?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, I think that what was done in Washington did have an impact on what Mr. Bishop had concluded was maybe the best way to proceed. So it was discussed, but after our work group meeting, I was unaware of what had happened in Washington State, mostly in the area of health care. When we hear what Washington State has done, we want to deviate substantially from that. But in this case, it looks like they, too, were headed toward trying to get the parties together so that it can be done in the best possible way for Oregon in this case.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I just add one small but important caveat? Mr. Powell's comments reminded me of this. To be accurate, I just received as well the -4 amendments earlier this afternoon, in fact, over the noon hour, I think. So I have not done the due diligence of providing these to my clients who are in the room as we talked about this. And I do think that the amendments abide by the spirit of what we talked about and agreed with Mr. Wilson, but I need to send those to my client. That doesn't mean that I'm asking you to stop your action today. I think we'll have time to deal with that if there's a problem. I don't believe there will be, but we just got them today, so I just wanted to insert that for the record. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Can we have Mr. Holt come up? Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
I think we're all interested. You're really the only voice we haven't heard from as far as the -4s are concerned.
Oh, yeah.
Chair Garrard and members of the committee, our association contracted with Mr. Wilson on this bill, and he absolutely has our clearance on this. So we concur with the -4 amendments.
Any questions of Mr. Holt? Mr. Staff, thank you. Do you have any direction from the chair as to what he wanted?
I apologize. I did not get direction on the chair. His wishes
think,
on this bill.
Okay, what we'll do is have the committee stand at ease until we can check in with the chair to see exactly what the deposition of this bill is. So we'll stand.